It is October 12th, 2025. The quarterback controversy at the top of the depth chart on the Football Scoop podcast is raging as I, Zach Barnett, am once again piloting the offense. To my right on my screen is Doug Samuels. To my bottom is John Bryce. Gentlemen, how are we?
Great. Good, ZB. There's no controversy. Your consistency has won the job.
You know what? That's anything I've ever accomplished in my life has not been through overwhelming talent. It's just simple consistency. So we'll see if we can move the offense downfield, score some points. So I was reporting live for Football Scoop from the south end of the stadium at the Cotton Bowl yesterday. So I have a lot of thoughts on that and not much on anything else that happened before that. So the result of the day, arguably the result of the season so far, Indiana 30, Oregon 20. I didn't see a snap of this game, so you guys tell me how the heck this happened.
It happened because Indiana was able to overcome mistakes. It had a pick six that Mendoza threw, and it didn't get rattled in one of the toughest environments of all of college football. And then Indiana made Dante Moore look like a redshirt sophomore. And I think that was the difference in the game. Indiana did what I thought was unthinkable at Oregon. It played with more resolve than the home team, in my opinion.
That game just solidified for me, and we've sang Kurt Cignetti's praises for the past 2 years, right? But we are witnessing the greatest college coaching job of our generation. Like to go into a place like Bloomington and turn that program around so immediately – we may never see something like that in our lifetime. And this was the rubber stamp on the Kurt Cignetti tenure. Like they he needed it. Could they have survived without it? Sure. But they went in there and just outperformed. Outside of the false starts, there were far too many of those in the first half and in second half key situations. But they were never rattled. They just kept winning. They went one from snap to snap. Oregon got a lot of love heading into that matchup about the size disparity up front. Oregon was like averaging like, I don't know, 320 on the offensive line, and Indiana was like 280 on the defensive line. And Indiana's defensive line did outstanding. Dante Moore, like JB said, looked mortal. He threw two picks. He was sacked six times by that Hoosier defensive line. And that was really where Indiana won this game in the trenches, in a game where they were not expected to. And then their skill players looked every bit as fast, every bit as talented as the Ducks. Elijah Surratt is one of the most underrated receivers in college football for now the second year. Like, can't sleep on that dude. He's a dog.
Yeah, that's a great point on Surratt. Like, he's as good as any wide receiver right now in the country. Like, he's got to be on every Biletnikoff watch list. And then to your point, Doug, a great one about the sacks. And Dante Moore is not tackling a statue. Like, he typically does not absorb a lot of sacks. He just could not get away from them. I think maybe most striking in the box score is at home. Oregon only had 14 first downs, Zach. 14 first downs in a game at home. Indiana was on the field about 6.5 minutes more in time of possession. And Oregon didn't even have 270 yards of total offense. Those are things like you just do not expect to see that whatsoever. I thought that Indiana would play him tough and that Oregon would kind of systematically pull away in the second half. And it was Indiana who pulled away. Like, it was not a fluke. Like, Indiana earned that 10-point win. And Indiana took Dan Lanning out of who he characteristically is because of the flow of the game. There was a point in the second half when Indiana was ahead 13-10. And Oregon had it 4th and 2 at the 16-yard line and kicked a game-tying field goal. That's not Dan Lanning. That is, we do not see Dan Lanning make that decision to kick a field goal, especially at home. I mean, Dan Lanning's team plays its butts off for him because of the way he leads. But that's what Indiana did. To me, that was very striking.
So the fact that Indiana made lots of mistakes, 6 false starts, pick 6, and 1 by 10 – this is not one of those where we play them 10 times, we beat them 1. Like, it does it sound like if they played again tomorrow, where would you guys set the line?
It doesn't matter. Indiana won. Like, any given Saturday, anything can happen. And Cignetti's group is the real deal, man. And I love it.
Yeah, they're going to be number three today. Like, we'll see how quickly this podcast gets to the airwaves before, if it's before the polls come out, or I don't know. But Indiana will be number three behind Ohio State and Miami. And I wouldn't be surprised to get Indiana, to see Indiana getting some number one votes today.
I vote in the Super 16 poll run by the Football Writers Association and the National Football Foundation. I voted them number two. All respect due to Miami. They've got a great resume. But Indiana now has two top 10 wins where they've won them both by double digits. And it's funny because they take the general consensus on this Indiana team is, yeah, they'll probably have a better team than they were last year, but they're going to have a worse record. I mean, you got Illinois, a top 10 team. You got to go to Autzen. You get to Beaver Stadium. They can't win those. You're looking at it now, they're not going to play another ranked team. They're scheduled from here on out. Michigan State, UCLA at Maryland, at Penn State, Wisconsin, at Purdue. We live in a world where their toughest game remaining might be UCLA.
Yeah, that's crazy town, banana land. They won't face a ranked team until the Big Ten championship game.
And it's probably going to be 12-0 Indiana versus 12-0 Ohio State. Like, that's the – I don't know what percentage it is, but it's above 50%. And they're going to be playing for the number one overall seed. The loser might get the number two overall seed.
Zach, as a voter, was there any thought into putting Indiana number one, or was it Ohio State clear number one? Just based on look, common opponents, Indiana blows out Illinois. Ohio State played them a little bit closer. Was there that thought cross your mind at all?
Yeah, there's arguments to be made there, but for me personally, and this is how I think, is Ohio State's going to be number one until someone beats them. The fact that they're the defending national champions. As talented as they are in the headsets and the helmets, in my rankings, they'll be number one until someone beats them.
And I thought that's a great question, Doug, and a really good point, because it is, we're deep enough into the season that I think common opponent criteria matters. And each team's played six games or whatever. I do think Ohio State got pretty bored pretty quickly with the Illini yesterday. It was 20-0 after the first quarter. And I thought from that point forward, that the Buckeyes were honestly in a march against time to just get the game over as quickly as possible. It was a 11 o'clock local time kickoff. They wanted to get back to Columbus. I watched a good bit of that game. I didn't get the sense that Ohio State was ever shaking in its LeBron cleats or anything like that.
Yeah, my take was that going into the game, I was asked about it, and I said if Illinois could start every single drive at the Ohio State 20-yard line, they'd have a chance to win the game. But that might not have been enough. It seems like Ryan Day's biggest opponent moving forward is going to be complacency. You've got Wisconsin at Wisconsin on Saturday. Penn State, they're not going to be what they thought. And then Purdue, UCLA, Rutgers before you go to Michigan. Obviously, Michigan's going to have Ohio State's full attention. Everyone else remains to be seen. Let's stay in the Big Ten. Penn State. Is the bottom falling out? Is this program entering the same death spiral that we've seen UCLA, Oklahoma State, Virginia Tech enter? And obviously those schools have already rendered judgments on their head coaches. I'm not saying Penn State's going to do the same, but it looks like a program in a death spiral.
I think that I said this on a podcast appearance yesterday. Penn State's season officially ended October 11th, 2025. I mean, it's over, and that's not a shred of hyperbole. You're coming off of a semifinal run. You return your most expensive roster in the relatively short history of overtly paying players. You had Drew Aller back. You had Nicholas Singleton and Catron Allen back. You had a very veteran offensive line and still a bunch of really good players on defense, and you've lost three games in a row. You're the first program since 1978 to lose back-to-back games as a 20-plus point favorite. We know that James Franklin hears, sees, reads everything, so we know how much this is needling him and bothering him. And they're in complete disarray, and there are 50 or 60 millions why – there's not going to be 50 or 60 million reasons why there's not going to be any sort of regime change in Unhappy Valley, but we're not at October 15th and their season is over. And there's just no scenario where this season for Penn State can have any big picture meaning to it. Now, I hate the Drew Aller injury because that dude is really tough, and he has taken certainly an insane amount of criticism for his play still as a college football player. The only shred for Penn State that is just truly grasping for a silver lining is that they'll be forced to start playing a new quarterback now, which could, in theory, give them a chance to start building towards 2026. But 2025 is over.
Doug, you're the head coach of this podcast. If you're James Franklin and you got to stand in front of a team meeting today, tomorrow, whenever Penn State gathers again, what do you tell your, what do you stand in front of your 100 and so guys and tell them?
I mean, it's funny you say that, because I'm in, as a head coach, I'm kind of in the same, not the same spot as James Franklin, but I felt like we entered our season with a lot of hope and optimism and thought we could be really good, and it hasn't panned out that way to this point of the season. Lost to a team on Friday that I feel like we were more talented than and better coaching staff than, and we found a way to lose. And Brett Bielema said something after their loss to Ohio State that, you know, before you win, you've got to stop losing. And that struck a chord with me today, just because where we're at in our season. But that's kind of where James Franklin is. I mean, team play has played uninspired football through the past three games, to put it mildly. The fan base, especially the past 2 weeks, has turned absolutely toxic. To see some of the people in the stands and the Fire Franklin chants as he's trying to greet each of his players coming off the field, I couldn't imagine being in that headspace. And for James Franklin, you know, you wonder, he's got like a $48 or $49 million buyout, so to fire him is almost off the table at this point. But you almost wonder, if you're in James Franklin's shoes, do you think about a career reset? Like, is it time to go somewhere and kind of relight that fire? I'm not saying that it is, but I also felt like he's made some of the top coordinator hires on paper. If I could have ranked the top offensive coordinator hires over the past 3 or 4 years, Garrett Riley at Clemson would be up there, and Andy Kotelnicki, I think, would have been up there for Penn State. And that just has not panned out for them the way that you expected it to. And part of that, I think, is losing a dynamic player like Tyler Warren, the tight end that went into the draft last year, that was a really special talent. But those are the questions that he's got to face. What do you say to the team? I'm not sure I have a great answer for that. Like, you've got to win one game a week and make it a one-game season each and every week. And like JB said, maybe the quarterback shuffle sparks something in this group, but to watch how his players greeted him coming, or greeted each other coming off the field, there's some definite frustrations in the locker room that have to be met head on. And knowing what I know about James Franklin, what we know about James Franklin, I think he meets that challenge head on. But I would agree with JB, like October 11th, 2025 is the day that their season really came to an end. It'll be interesting to see if we see players opting out at Penn State for the rest of the season, and all that kind of stuff will tell us about the locker room environment in Happy Valley.
And look at the striking disparity in response between Texas and Penn State, the two teams that entered the season preseason number one and number two, both entered yesterday with losses. And Texas rose to the occasion against a vastly superior opponent to what Penn State faced yesterday, and found a way to not only win, but to potentially find some more long-term answers that gives Texas hope. And Texas is in a position to where potentially at 9-3, it would probably be in the playoff field, but it gives itself hope and just responded in great fashion. That was a program win for Texas, every bit as much as yesterday was a program loss for Penn State. And I think that's what's so damning. And also at home, you had a Northwestern squad that had its offense on the field 9.5 minutes. Northwestern was on the field for almost 35 minutes of that game in your house. A Northwestern team that is not an offensive juggernaut, that has not put up huge numbers, that has not been able to really lay on the field against any quality opposition this year. So all of those things are damning. I love the I love the Frank insight there that you provided, Doug, and talking about, you wonder where James Franklin's headspace is. Occasionally coaches will reach out to all of us and talk to us about the job market around the sport and talk to us about their various thoughts. And I don't have very much wisdom at all, but the only thing I ever tell a coach that I think resonates is you want to pull the ripcord a year too soon than a year too late. You want to hit that reset button a year too soon than a year too late. Because if you wait a year too late, you may never be in control of the reset button again.
So Penn State, that's absolutely correct. And I could think of a handful of coaches who were on the wrong side of that reset button. But so you mentioned Doug. It's a one game season. Here's Penn State's next 3 1 game seasons: at Iowa, at number 1 Ohio State, home against number 7, soon to be number 2 or 3 Indiana. You're looking at 3-6 is very, very, very much on the table for them. So let's transition to the other, as John mentioned, the preseason number 1 team. I was privileged to attend this game, and I wish I was walking out of that stadium yesterday thinking of you boys, wishing y'all could be there to experience this, because there's nothing in college football like it. Being inside that stadium, the intensity. I haven't been to Ohio State, Michigan, the Iron Bowl, so but I can't imagine any game surpasses it from intensity. And then you go out, and your alma mater wins the game, and you're eating a turkey leg that's about this big. There's a pirate ship over here doing this, and one of those tilt-a-whirl deals over here where you sit in the chair and it spins you around. And then there's a 92,000-seat stadium about as the crow flies, about 50 feet in front of you. It's an experience unlike anything else in America, unlike anything else in college football. And when your alma mater wins it, it's a whole lot more fun. So going into this, I had some intel that John Mateer was going to play. So was not surprised, but was surprised at how poorly he played. It was a really bad day for him, really bad day for Brent Venables. You saw some of his bad habits, his back foot throws, his YOLO balls. Texas intercepted him 3 times. Probably could have had 4 or 5 easily. Jelani McDonald, Texas safety, had a pick 6 that he dropped. They had a fumble, a lateral that they didn't recover that easily could have been a scoop and score for Texas as well. You knew both teams would struggle to run the ball, and which teams found a way to run the ball with their running back would find a way to win the game, and Texas was able to do it. That if this season for Texas ends up becoming something, the turning point will be that first drive of the third quarter. They got the ball, went 75 yards, and took nearly half the quarter, most of it on the ground. Trey Weiser was able to find creases, bounce off tackles, some poor open field tackling from Oklahoma. They scored the one offensive touchdown of the game, and that was kind of all she wrote, because Oklahoma's offense had 0 answers against the Texas defense. And that's all we wrote for that game.
I was trying to defer to Doug. My biggest question, Zach, is do you remember when did pirate ships first sail into the middle of Texas?
You know, I'm not sure how this one got there. It doesn't look like a great seafaring vehicle, but it was moving quite a bit for the people that it's literally in the shadow of the Cotton Bowl. Like, you need to be there to experience it, and I can't recommend the experience enough to everyone.
As a Midwesterner, as you're explaining that scene, I thought the game got moved to Raymond James Stadium or something in Tampa. Yeah. I was unaware of it. That's just how tough for a Midwesterner to wrap his head around that scene.
You know, kudos to Arch. He completed like 75% of his passes, did not turn the ball over, and Texas won all 3 phases. Let's not forget, the game was over with Texas's return for a touchdown. And so you noted the turnovers that Texas forced. Oklahoma really stifled on offense despite having a 6-0 lead. If you're in a game and one single play can put you behind on the scoreboard, you really don't have much of a lead. And so I thought that was a program win for Texas. That was a plant your flag moment, and the Longhorns did just that.
We talked
two key plays. Go ahead, Doug.
We talked last week about Texas drops that one, and they're very realistically looking at a 6-6 like season, and so to get that one was absolutely huge. I know Mateer played hurt, was bloodied, hand was bloodied most of the game. I admire the grit of that dude, man, to want to play in that rivalry game, find a way to make it happen, even though he maybe shouldn't have been playing, but just the sheer grit to play in a game of that magnitude with your throwing hand, you know, I don't want to say in shambles, it was in a little bit better shape than that, but just the grit and mental fortitude it took for him to gut through that win or gut through that game and try to will his team to win deserves a ton of credit.
Yeah, I thought yesterday, I mean, the atmosphere in that stadium, all eyes were on number 10 in white. And so the roar he got every time he came out was admirable from the Oklahoma fans. But I thought yesterday, you know, Sooner magic is a real thing with that program and the ability to conjure victories out of nothing. And you thought if they were to go out and win that game with Mateer having a good game, you'd have him instantly shoot to Baker Mayfield level reverence within that program. And instead, yesterday was about worst case scenario for them because the score probably wouldn't have been a whole lot different if Michael Hawkins had played. And at least then you have something of a mulligan in the eyes of your fan base, the eyes of the committee. But instead, Mateer played, the offense still looked inept. And the offense has real problems, and you don't have, well, we get our quarterback back, things will be different. This is who they are. Mateer 77th in passing efficiency right now. He's only created 11 touchdowns through five games. So there's a real lack of dynamism in their offense. That was the case last season. And the parts have changed, but the results really haven't against good defenses. So that's Oklahoma. For Texas, the two key plays of the game were the third down touchdown pass, the only touchdown, where DeAndre Moore just ran right past two Oklahoma defenders, and neither one of them picked him up and found himself wide open in the end zone, which is frankly shocking, given how good Oklahoma's defense is, how poor Texas traditionally is in the red zone. And then the key play of the game for me was Arch Manning in his own end zone with Texas leading 10-6 on a third and seven, throwing a dot to Parker Livingstone on the sideline, double coverage. That really flipped the game because otherwise Texas is punting from its own end zone, only up four. They went on to get a field goal and really put the game away. Doug, you were in the Kalen DeBoer black hoodie of death. So let's talk through Alabama 27, Missouri 24. I didn't see eyes on much of this game, so what do I need to know?
Few takeaways from that one. I was really impressed with Missouri's defensive line. They got pressure on Alabama's Ty Simpson all night long. Did a really nice job. Alabama was trying to use chips by tight ends and things like that before getting out on routes. That worked sparingly. And also Missouri is a legit SEC team. Like they were able to run the ball. I know you sang the praises of their running back last Thursday, played really, really well. I just think the loss to Florida State for Alabama at the beginning of the year has been the best thing that probably could have happened to this Alabama team. They seem like a whole new team since that point. Have rattled off now five straight wins and seem like one of the top teams in the SEC.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how much pressure that Missouri got on Alabama yesterday. And the Alabama right tackle had just a horrific day. I mean, a flat-out terrible day. But the Alabama offensive line overall had a very terrible day. After about Alabama's first two possessions, Zach, I think Alabama had like 130 yards after its first two offensive possessions and then had less than 200 yards the rest of the day. So what Missouri did, I mean, Ty Simpson was lucky to be walking upright at the end of that game because he got the absolute hell beat out of him. And you want to talk about somebody who showed a lot of toughness, it's Ty Simpson. But we just watched Alabama go to Georgia and take the fight to Georgia and really control that game wire to wire. I know it ended up a three-point game and Georgia had certainly its opportunities, but Ty Simpson never took a beating at any point in that Georgia game at Georgia the way he got hammered yesterday by Missouri. And again, like with Caden Proctor on that line and Parker Brailsford at center and some of the other pieces, we don't see Alabama look like that from an offensive line standpoint very often at all. And you know, they made Alabama's O-line look incredibly pedestrian, just incredibly very average. And that's credit to Missouri. We wrote recently, and Scott and I in our intel piece about the job that Corey Batun is doing. And we had had some agents tell us, pay attention because he may be a guy who surges, to a G5 head coaching candidate. And Corey Batun had his unit playing the part yesterday for the Missouri Tigers.
So if you had to bet your life on, I think the safest bet within the SEC is Ty Simpson to be the first team all SEC quarterback, largely due to probably 50% due to his own play, 50% due to lack of competition. But if you had to bet your life on an SEC championship matchup right now, I think Alabama is the safest bet for sure, being 3-0 with three top 20 wins, two of those on the road. The other one, another 3-0 in that team in the SEC, plays Texas A&M, who took a Florida team that beat Texas last week and really ran away from them, dominated the second half of this game, 13-3. They are now 3-0 and probably moving up in the top five. What'd you guys think of this one?
I Texas A&M, superior depth and explosiveness and consistency on offense. There's that word again. But from a 14-14 game after the end of the first quarter to Texas A&M winning the balance of the game 20-3, I just thought Florida remains very Jekyll and Hyde. DJ Lagway didn't turn it over yesterday. He made overall better decisions. And Marcel Reed did turn it over, but there's just more dynamics from that Texas A&M offense. And frankly, I just think there's more consistency in every phase of the game for the Aggies than there is for the Florida Gators. And I thought that's honestly what stood out to me, is like Texas A&M knows who it is. It stuck to who it is and it played to who it is over four quarters, and Florida could not match that.
Very controversially on this podcast, when my bold prediction would be that Texas would miss the college football playoff, I said it because they would lose a road game at Kentucky or Mississippi State. And it's perhaps I just read the flames wrong with my vision from Brelore when perhaps the
what the hell are you quoting? Your vision from who?
I had to get a Game of Thrones reference in there. That's my long way of saying perhaps I was mistaken and I read the prophecy wrong, and it was Florida would be the sub 500 SEC team that Texas lose to, because Florida now, I guess you could take solace in the fact that you're the most talented 2-4 team in college football, but Florida is nonetheless 2-4 on this season.
The man has no name. The man has no name.
All right, so we're 27 minutes in and we haven't talked about probably the biggest mess of a game yesterday, and that would be Georgia finding a way to beat Auburn. And Auburn is very much in Murphy's Law territory, where everything that can go wrong will go wrong for them. I was in transit when this happened. I saw Auburn trying to do the tush push into the end zone to take a 17-0 lead. And then the next thing I knew, it was 10-3 Georgia. So what the heck happened?
Doug?
I mean, I think that moment happen. The quarterback's reaching over the line. It kind of gets punched out. And there's a lot of talk about, did the ball break the plane? Well, what does break the plane mean? Does that mean the front part of the goal line? Does it mean the back part of the goal line? Is it the middle part of the goal line? What does that actually mean? I think there's a lot of debate. Zach, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, my understanding is the tippy tip tip of that football, once it reaches the first blade of grass of white on that goal line, you're in the end zone.
That was my understanding as well. And if that is the case, then I think they got robbed of a touchdown right there. And they had all the momentum in the world going for them. Coulda, woulda, shoulda blown the game wide open. But the other culprit here is the flip phone cameras that we're using in the pylons. Like, that looked like footage from Tecmo Bowl. It was so pixelated. Like, how do we not have 4K cameras in there to help us make the right call in that situation?
NFL games, I've seen they'll take the sky cam and literally put it over the action. I guess Jordan Hare is not equipped to do that.
No, I think there was sky cam. I thought it was indicated to me that the replay crew had the overhead sky cam. I don't understand how there wasn't enough to I don't understand how it got ruled a fumble to begin with instead of the touchdown as soon as that ball. Again, it's the nose of the ball. If it's seen all over any portion of white, that's the touchdown. And that's what happened. I'll tell you how bad it was. I was getting text messages from Kentucky people and Tennessee people saying the SEC is out to screw Auburn. And so whether you believe that or not, I say this all the time, especially Kentucky and Tennessee. If you get Kentucky and Tennessee people independently agreeing on something, you've got the Yankees and the Red Sox singing Kumbaya. You've got the 49ers and the Cowboys. Like, you've got Michigan and Ohio State agreeing on something. So I do think it's egregious, and I'll continue to hammer home the point that we need more public accountability for college football officiating, officiating in general, especially. Yeah, there's some kids now in college football absolutely making life-changing, forever life-changing money. The great majority still are not making forever life-changing money, but they come out and they talk to slaps like me, win or lose, and they talk to people like you, Zach, bless you. They talk to people like you, Zach, after an unbelievable atmosphere and then dejection Friday night for North Texas. And why do we treat the officials like sacred cows? I don't get it. Like, yes, they have a damn hard job that I do not think I could probably do very well whatsoever. But come out and explain it to us. Like, explain why it's so hard in human terms, and explain what you saw and go from there. I hope Greg Sankey gets controversy for this week. I think he needs to own it. I think he needs to wear it. And I think we need to hear from the SEC.
Well, and then you had that. And then also Kirby Smart clearly calling timeout. And then the refs get okey-doked into saying, no, I was clapping. No one in the world ever claps like this.
Yeah. Now here's what I think. I think he called timeout and he was accusing Auburn of clapping and wanted a penalty. So I don't think Kirby Smart lied and said he was clapping and not calling a timeout. I've watched that. I saw it live and I watched it a number of times. I think there's a bunch of bad takes out there that Kirby Smart claimed he was clapping and not calling a timeout. I think Kirby Smart was telling the officials, you guys are blowing yet another call because they're clapping and that's a new penalty. That's a new rule, and that's supposed to be a 5-yard penalty on them. They can't do that. I'm having to waste a timeout. And I think that's why Georgia didn't get whistled for a timeout. And I don't think that timeout meant anything in the grand scheme of that contest. But I don't think that Kirby Smart was claiming he was clapping. I think he called a timeout to tell them, you're effing this up.
A thousand percent. JB, I think you're absolutely right. I've seen some clips of you know, the whole defense is zoomed in, no one's clapping, but then they zoom in on a safety and he's starting to walk down and he's clapping that Georgia is looking over at the sideline or something. So that's when Kirby calls the timeout and he's saying they're clapping. He wasn't saying that he was not calling a timeout at that time. I think you're absolutely right. But the if I'm Hugh Freeze, my issue is he called a timeout and was not then charged a timeout. So something happened in between there where that the official on that sideline came out and said, well, they didn't mean to use a timeout or something. And then maybe it's inconsequential. But if I'm Hugh Freeze, the heck that is inconsequential, because now you just put another timeout in their pocket as the play clock's dwindling down and you basically get a redo. I think that's another avenue that the SEC absolutely needs to have an answer for. Needed to be charged a timeout. No questions asked. Let's move on to the next play.
Yeah, and charge the timeout and then let Kirby Smart spend that entire timeout educating them on how they failed at their jobs in that moment. That's a great point, Doug. Here's the final thing I'll say about officiating and the travesty that was the Deep South's oldest rivalry. Auburn at home had 25 more penalty yards than Georgia had total rushing yards in that game. You tell me what sense that makes.
Well, speaking of Auburn, I mean, they've had absolutely three woe-is-me losses so far this season. I mean, Oklahoma gave a touchdown that was a penalty that should have been called a penalty and a 7-point loss, and then you had a penalty or touchdown taken away that should not have been. But at the same time, they played like a woe-is-me. You're still winning 10-3 at halftime, and before Georgia scored the decisive touchdown, Auburn had gained 25 yards of offense in the second half. That's it right there.
Yeah, it feels like there's kind of a victim mentality creeping in at Auburn when you see the coaching staff heading to the locker room, arguing with the officials, and the AD is hopping in on that. Like, that's not a great look for the, you know, the whole program.
Last game here is on my list within the SEC. Another one that I got zero eyes on, but I understand was a banger, was Tennessee surviving Arkansas. What do we have on that one?
Yeah, you know, we'll learn a lot more about Tennessee next week. They've had one real test, and they failed it because they couldn't preserve multiple two-touchdown leads at home against Georgia. They made Georgia look like an explosive offense when we know nothing could be further from the truth about Mike Bobo's unit this year. Workmanlike is a very generous term to describe the Georgia offense. But the Vols go to Alabama next weekend, the traditional third Saturday in October rivalry. I'll say this, Zach, if Tennessee finds a way to win that game, your all SEC quarterback might be Joey Swagular for the Vols. He is quietly putting together a very efficient, a very fine season. He didn't turn the ball over yesterday. He completed 65% of his passes, threw for a touchdown, distributed the ball really well. Tennessee was up 34-17 and then had to deal with a little bit of sphincter tightening late in the game. The Hogs looked a lot better for whatever the reason was, 2 weeks to prepare, whatever you want to say it. They did look more sound on defense, and certainly you could see Bobby Petrino orchestrating that offense with Talon Green playing at a really high level.
One last shot I forgot to get off Georgia Auburn. The Sean McDonough, Greg McElroy crew is as good as we have in college football, but I thought they had a really weird moment at the end of that game when Gunnar Stockton ran in and scored the touchdown. Both of those guys were absolutely harping on Stockton for scoring a touchdown, because now he committed the sin of giving Auburn the football back. And I just wanted to scream at my TV, yeah, you're giving the football back, but you're up 10 points, guys. You've watched Auburn's offense. They're not scoring 10 points in a minute and 50. They wouldn't score 10 points in 150 minutes. Like, the ultimate way to protect your deep, they're trying to make the point that the only way Auburn can win is if they have the football. The ultimate way to protect your defense is to score points. Am I right, Doug?
And to make it a two-score game at that point, it's tough to argue with that logic. But, you know, the other way to keep the other team from scoring is to hang on to the football. So, you know, you got six in one hand, half dozen in the other.
Yeah. I think it was like a minute 50 left. Auburn still had a timeout. So if either you kick the field goal or you take a knee on fourth down or whatever, if you're trying to possess the ball as long as you possibly can. Either way, you're giving Auburn the football back in that scenario in a one-score game with 5 seconds left, but you're still – this is the place where the prayer at Jordan-Hare happened. It's a 10-point game and a game where Auburn's offense has done nothing in the entire second half. Just a really weird moment from an otherwise A-plus broadcast crew.
Yeah, the kick six happened to Jordan-Hare. And to their credit, those two guys said it should have been a touchdown on the Auburn play. Like, they were incredulous that it was not ruled a touchdown and then that it was not overruled. But you know my thoughts on that. Never stop trying to score touchdowns. If you keep scoring touchdowns, you can't lose the freaking game. And we've seen it in recent weeks. We saw too many people shrivel up and settle for field goals or whatever. And I said it earlier in this podcast, if one play can put you behind, you really don't have a lead.
John, I assume I haven't spoken to you about this. I assume you will be in South Bend or in Notre Dame Stadium next Saturday night for what is now a big, big USC at Notre Dame game. And that is big because USC manhandled Michigan. I thought Michigan was going to do the manhandling, and instead it was USC.
Yeah, I was impressed. That's probably under Lincoln Riley, I would contend that is maybe USC's most complete win because they were the more physical team and they took the fight to Michigan and they suffocated Michigan. And Michigan's not very good on offense, but they have a big offensive line and they've been able to wear some people out. And they just really suffocated Michigan. And so I thought that was significant. I will be in what they have dubbed college football's cathedral next Saturday night. And of note, as of right now, It's the last contracted meeting between Notre Dame and USC for the foreseeable future. The two sides have been in a bit of a impasse or a game, a crazy game of poker, whatever you want to say. But there's not, the contract ends technically right now. We'll see what happens moving forward. But USC looked really good. Jaden Mayava, who's always had elite arm talent, is now matching that with more accuracy than he's ever displayed before. Completed almost 80% of his passes yesterday in that win. Still threw a turnover. He's got to cut down on his turnovers, but still did a lot of good things there. They got a really good rushing attack yesterday. Had a guy go for about $150 against the Wolverines. We haven't seen too many people individually generate that kind of success against the Michigan defense. And again, they were just they were the more physical team, and it's been very, very rare here in year four of Lincoln Riley and Troy that you could say the men of Troy were the more physical team.
Agreed. Go ahead, Doug.
They
look top to bottom really, really talented. The Lemon receiver, number six for USC, is incredible, man. He makes plays every week. You know, the one thing I want to say about that game is I think tempo really gave Wink Martindale's defense some issues. And Brett Bielema said the same thing about Matt Patricia. So you got Patricia and Wink, both NFL coordinators. What do you not see a ton of in the NFL is tempo. Brett Bielema's team, I think, threw 44 times. That's a lot for a Brett Bielema coach team against Ohio State. And he said after the game, he felt they had more success when they were up-tempo and wishes they went up-tempo more. And then you flip that over to USC, and they were super efficient with the football on first and second down. They weren't facing a bunch of third and longs, and they tempoed. I mean, Lincoln Riley is a tempo guy, and that I think if you're going to make some headway against these really star-studded NFL, former NFL coordinators and Wink Martindale and Matt Patricia, I think tempo is the way you're going to do it. You're not going to line up and break a huddle and match brains in a chess match with those guys. You've got to get them on their heels a little bit. There's no better way to do that than tempo.
Well, that's really brilliant insight from you, Doug. I like that, and that plays directly into the game that we're talking about next week, Notre Dame-USC, because who does Notre Dame have calling its defense now? Chris Ash, who came back to the college game from the NFL, had been with the Jaguars and a couple of other franchises, and so your point is pertinent to both yesterday and what Illinois did yesterday against Ohio State. It's also pertinent to next week's game inside Notre Dame Stadium.
All right, we're closing in on the 45-minute mark, so let's go rapid fire. I've got two games I want to talk about. We'll start here. Texas Tech 42, Kansas 17. So Tech jumped out early, and then Kansas came back in the second quarter. Baron Morton left the game. It seems like the amount of games that he plays stem to stern is much smaller than the amount of games he misses, either completely or missing time. I saw Matt Zenitz over at CBS reported that he should be good to go for next week. But that Will Hammond played the remainder of that game. Didn't play great, but it didn't matter because Cameron Dickey ran 21 times for 263 yards and two touchdowns, and the defense pitched a second-half shutout. So run game and defense is exactly what we all have come to think of Texas Tech football, right?
Positively. For me, two late-night games that had me captivated is Utah just got absolutely righteous against Arizona State, and the most complete performance we've seen from Utah against a quality opponent in multiple years because they were very disappointing a year ago, and they dealt with quarterback issues and the injury, the ongoing injury saga to Cam Rising for multiple seasons before that, but just absolutely annihilated the Sun Devils 42-10. There's not going to be any repeat of the magic in the Valley of the Sun for Arizona State to return to the college football playoff this year. BYU finding a way to win, up 14-0 at Arizona. Arizona shows a lot of grit and resolve, gets that game tied, had multiple chances to win it, sends it into a couple of overtimes, has to settle for a field goal, and BYU very methodically scores a touchdown to win that game, setting up undefeated BYU against one-loss Utah next Saturday night under the lights. in the Holy War. That's going to be an amazing game at Lavelle Edwards Stadium. Fox has grabbed it for its 8 o'clock kickoff. As we discussed in the Thursday podcast, the Big 12, Big 12 wants success for all of its teams. It really wanted to have one loss Utah against undefeated BYU for the value of the conference. And that's going to be an awesome game next Saturday night. The mountains there on the Wasatch Range are already snow-capped, and it's going to be a spectacular setting for college football. Yes, I'm a nerd. I'm very excited already for that game.
Hey, two things to mention, right? One of my coaching icks on Saturday is anytime a head coach from a losing team gets up there and cries and moans about something that has absolutely nothing to do with the game. That was Lance Leipold after the Texas Tech game. You know, they had kind of a heated moment with Joey McGuire at the handshake thing, and apparently he was complaining about the tortillas being thrown on the field. Like, we're talking about soft tortillas being thrown on the field, and that's what we're going to complain about at the end of the game. Now, he did say one of his staff members was hit with a pocket knife. Like, now, if we're throwing knives and stuff, that's an issue. But throwing tortillas onto a field is not an issue to whine and cry about after a game, right? So that's had to mention that. And it seems like there's one of those every week, whether it's James Franklin, the travel, or whatever it happens to be, always gets under my skin a little bit. The one win I want to tip the cap to is Eddie George in Bowling Green knocking off Toledo with Pudge the Cat. That's a really big win for Eddie George and his first year leading the Falcons to knock off a program like Toledo. And I think it was last Tuesday or whatever, I was talking about some of the underappreciated coaches on that Toledo staff. For Eddie George and his guys to go in there and get a win is a big one in the MAC.
Yeah. Love that. That's a Eddie George. That's a huge win. And Jason Candle and that Toledo program has been really the most consistent model along with Miami of Ohio for a really long time in that league. And so that's a win. That's more than just one win, in my opinion. To your note about the whining over travel and all of that stuff, I want to point out Tim Skipper's comments yesterday. And him saying, we don't care about the travel line. We're not going to come up here and make excuses. We got on a plane. We flew to East Lansing. He pretty much said, we whipped their ass and we'll get on the plane and go home. The other one that we've spent plenty of time on, but I had this pointed out to me last night in a text and again this morning, is that SIG in Indiana, they still flew in and got to Oregon on Friday night. They didn't fly a day early. They got there Friday night. They got up Saturday morning. And they whipped some butt, and they got on the plane and flew back home. So you can make excuses or you can make a way, and those are two guys that made two of the biggest ways this weekend.
So two things. I don't mean to laugh at a Kansas staffer getting hit with a pocket knife. That's obviously a very dangerous situation. But I laugh because – thank God. But I laugh because if you ask me to bet $5 on any Big 12 fan base that would throw a pocket knife – I would say save your $5. I'll bet my entire life savings. I know it's Texas Tech. I say this affectionately because I'm married to a Texas Tech grad. Texas Tech, the fan base, treats authority with no more reverence than a substitute teacher. That is a fan base of ADHD children. So, and Joey McGuire did say after the game that, like, I think he apologized and said we need to get this under control. So we'll see if they can. It might make the Tech fan base worse. We'll see. That's Texas Tech for you. And any Tech fan listening to this knows I'm dead on accurate there, which is a rare thing for me. My other point, I was there at DATQ Stadium Friday night. Wrote about it on the site, which I encourage everyone to read. I wrote about it from the North Texas perspective, but I want to give South Florida their flowers. They gave up three turnovers in the first quarter, allowed North Texas to be in the game, but only gave up 7 points off those three turnovers, and then ended up forcing six of their own. And South Florida, you can see why they went to the Swamp and beat Florida. I say this with all due respect, they have some fire hydrants body types on that defense and really throughout that roster. They were just running over and through North Texas players. So I'm not going to put them in the playoff just yet, but they're my group of five pick because they are the real deal from an athletic perspective to get that group of five bid.
I have a couple of quick FCS shout outs. Mike Jacobs and Mercer have now reeled off five in a row after an early season loss to Presbyterian, which remains undefeated and remains the nation's longest winning streak at the NCAA D1 level. They've now won 10 in a row dating back to last season. That's huge for them. And then Western Carolina, a massive win, and Tarleton State, 7-0 at the FCS level. They've got a couple of the most quality FCS wins of anybody out there. So shout out to those three FCS programs, flat getting it done.
All right, gentlemen. Well, we've carried this thing 50 minutes. My legs and back are sore. I don't know about you guys, so I'm going to go hit the showers, and we'll regroup for Tuesday. That's it. That's it for everyone. Thank you for listening. We'll be back Tuesday at full strength. Tell your friends, tell your wife, tell your dog. We're out.